Thank you. Great. So thank you all for coming. What I thought I would do today is to talk about some of the ways in which I think we're moving from a kind of a modernist, nationalist understanding of language, identity, and culture as part of homogeneous wholes, as tied to the idea of the homogeneous and territorially fixed nation state, to a way of understanding language in a shape that I like to think of as post-national, but essentially which indexes moving from understanding language in political and cultural terms to understanding language in more economic terms, as a resource, as a commodity, under conditions of late capitalism. So what I'm going to do is talk a little bit first about that global shift, if you like, and then I want to talk a little bit about some of the consequences of this shift for how we understand language education and language in education, especially in what we have come to know as minority language education. And I'll talk more specifically about how some of these shifts are playing out in the area where I live, bring up my kids, do my work, and do my ethnography in Francophone Canada. There's lots of other domains where we could talk about some of these broader political, economic, and discursive shifts. We could talk about translation, we could talk about tourism, we could talk about information technology, we could talk about IT, we could talk about call centers. But Sari's advice to me was that the area of language education, minority language education, might correspond best to your areas of interest, and I'm certainly happy to talk about other things as well in the discussion period. So let me start then with some of the more general and framing ideas. So my point of departure is that we are sort of emerging from a fairly long period in which ideas about modern nationalism have been hegemonic. And I take a lot of these ideas from Eric Hobsbawm, in particular, in his work on the emergence of the nation state in the 19th century Europe in particular. And so his argument is that the emergence of the nation state, this is sort of obviously an overly reduced and simplified discussion, but it'll do for now, emerged in with the growth of industrial capitalism and of the industrial bourgeoisie in various parts of Europe in the late 18th, early 19th centuries. And so the idea of nation states is to provide a basis for national markets, which have been legitimized through the notion that there are these organic things called nations, which are territorially fixed, have a continuous history on a particular territory, and have homogeneous populations. So that homogeneity is usually understood as homogeneity in terms of shared history, in terms of shared cultural practices, in terms of shared language, and in terms of shared identity and territory. And so what we saw in the 1800s and through the 20th century to a large extent as well, the huge amount of work that went into the construction of this homogeneity and of this fixing, standardizing languages, fixing boundaries, and producing the national, the modern national citizen. That production went through a number of different agencies, but one of the most important agencies, one of the most important institutions of the modern nation state in the production of the monolingual, standard language speaking national citizen was, of course, the school. And so the construction of state education and democratic access to education was a really important, as Foucault would say, technology for the construction of the modern national citizen within a political economic regime based on industrial capitalism. David Harvey, Manuel Castells, and others have argued, Anthony Giddens, have argued that what characterizes the late 20th, early 21st century is not that that regime has completely fallen apart, but rather that what we have is a sort of a qualitative shift in, sorry, am I standing in the way of, of the PowerPoint, the qualitative shift, which has gone along with the very logic of industrial capitalism. So that if we understand that the major point for capitalism is to make profit, what you have to worry about are how do you enter into and successfully emerge out of competition? And so you have a continual search for cheaper sources of goods and cheaper sources of labor. And you also have the continual source for new products, which will be able to enter the market. And so what they argue is that what we have gotten, where we got to in about the 1970s, 1980s, was a fairly complete saturation of markets for industrial goods, and industrial goods which could be regulated through the modern nation state, which led to a kind of a shaking out of the relationship between state and global capital, so that while, as Hobsbawm argued, the state was always in many respects in the service of industrial capitalism, it had to become more explicitly in the service of global capitalism. And so the ability of capital and goods and labor to circulate more, more quickly and more widely around the globe. And so what you have is a nation state in some sense taking a step back from the national market and trying to facilitate the nation state's position in an increasing globalized economy. So we have the expansion of capital into new markets and towards cheaper sources of goods and labor, and that has had immediate effects, for example, in North America and parts of Europe, of deindustrialization as manufacturing has moved to places like China, for example. China has also represented a space for new markets, so that one of the things that the tobacco industry, for example, was thrilled about was the possibility of entering China, a whole new market, relatively untapped. The other ways in which things have changed, and this is particularly important, I think, for language, has been that we have the development of new niche markets and the development of new niche products. And so with all of these processes, you have the development of tertiarization, that is to say, the development of forms of labor which are not connected directly to the production of material goods, but which are either connected to the management of global flows, which can include multilingualism, but certainly includes the communicative management of global flows of capital, of goods, and of labor. And we also have the increasing mobilization of symbolic capital for reaching niche markets, for constructing niche markets, reaching niche markets, and constructing, providing added value to existing products. And then the final feature is flexibilization. As competition intensifies, things have to be able to move around faster and faster. So the sort of example that I'd like to give at this point is from a novel that was written in the early 20th century in Canada. It's something that most Anglophone North American girls read, and apparently is wildly popular in Japan as well. It's a novel called Anne of Green Gables, which is about, I don't know if you know it at all. Yeah, okay. So you know, all right, everybody's heard. All right. So, you know, you remember, so Anne is this, you know, girl who was an orphan, and she's adopted by these farm brother and sister in, you know, in a peripheral area of Canada, far away from the emerging centers of industrialism. And the piece that I remember is that there's one moment when, for the first time in her life, she sees in the window of a shop a pink plastic comb, a pink celluloid comb. And this becomes this huge object of desire for her, the first time she's seen something of that color that's produced industrially. So, you know, she doesn't want the old homemade comb that you have to use. That's sort of, you know, rural and kind of, you know, hicky. And she wants this industrial comb. I think today, most of us would look at a pink industrial, you know, plastic comb and go, you know, this is not, you know, I might pay 5 cents for this if I was desperate for a comb. We want exactly the combs that Anne rejected, the ones that are handmade, that might have be made out of wood, out of some natural product. Even better, might have like the flag of the area that we've just picked up this comb in, or some other way of designating that it's an authentic good. And so what I think has happened is that the semiotic resources that were produced by modern nationalism, flags, authentic cultural practices, languages that could be easily connected to identities and cultures, so that all of the work that was done to create these resources in the interest of legitimizing and authenticating nation states are now available for mobilization as symbolic added value in this, under these new conditions of late capitalism. And so we have then neoliberalism, broadly the shifting relationship between the state and capital. We have new sites of regulation, so not the nation state still is one, but we have supranational sites of regulation, we have more local sites of regulation, and generally speaking, the increased importance of language and communication, leading to, I think, two things. One is the increased commodification of language, culture, and identity. That is, the ability to mobilize these resources as values that are convertible to other kinds, other forms of capital. As commodities that are that have value in relations of capitalist exchange. But we also have, at this particular moment historically, a competition between authenticity, what Alexandre Duchesne and I sort of thought about as pride, sort of the older values of modern nationalism, and newer values of profit as sources of added value and legitimacy. And I think a lot of what we're seeing today in linguistic minority discourse is a tension between pride and profit. So one of the particular shifts, or the shifts that we see in the domain of education in particular, I think has to do with a shift from an emphasis on producing the real, the legitimate, the whole citizen, the good citizen, the moral citizen, to education as a place where individuals go to acquire particular kinds of skills, including what we think of as critical thinking, that is to say, skills that we as worker selves can mobilize in our own flexibilization in order to be able to compete with other workers for a place in the globalized new economy. Now, this can still mean competition for acquisition of authentic linguistic and cultural capital, not just technical skills, but you have a tension between language in particular in school understood as a technical skill or as a source of authentic symbolic value. And so we have schools as places where we're trying to produce not just citizens of the nation state, but global citizens able to integrate themselves into global markets. So we have in minority language education, certainly in the minority language schools of Francophone Canada that I've been involved with for a very long time, since the early 1980s, but also others that I've become familiar with through collaboration with colleagues here in Finland, in Catalonia, in Wales, and other Brittany, Corsica, other minority sort of canonical minority language areas. We have minority language schools which initially emerged out of rights-based discourses aimed at reproducing nationalism and which are now increasingly sites for resource-based discourses which are aimed at economic development. So let me tell you about how that particular transformation from a rights-based discourse to an economic resource-based discourse has played out in Francophone Canada. So I think the first thing that I need to say is that I don't know how much you know about Francophone Canada, so forgive me if I'm telling you stuff you already know, but it's important to recognize that French are in Canada first as a consequence of European imperialism, European colonialism. So it was once upon a time New France. And it was then taken over by Britain in the late 1700s, so that you have this kind of double colonialism going on in Canada, with British and French. But the French, the difference, if you like, that the French-English opposition made available for reasons having to do with, you know, long history of French-English antagonism in Europe. So that difference was mobilizable in the construction of class relations in Canada as Canada moved from a sort of really purely extractive colonial economy based essentially on the fur trade to a sort of combination primary resource extraction industrial economy through the 19th century and into the 20th. And so the French became mobilizable, or the French who were left, because the elite mainly left and went back to France after the British conquest, as what I like to think of as a mobile ethno-class. So that class relations in Canada get structured ethno-culturally as a way, in many respects, to legitimize and to mask those class relations. So the kinds of stereotypes that you would hear and that are still, to some extent, available today are things like, well, you know, the French are lots of fun and, you know, they like to sing and dance, but they really have no head for business. You want to get a business done properly, you need an English-speaking person for that. And the Francophones themselves internalized this idea by thinking of themselves as né pour un petit pain, born for a small loaf of bread, but at the same time spiritually superior to those horrible Anglos who, you know, all they ever think about is filthy money, which is not going to help you when judgment day comes. So for most of the 19th and early part of the 20th century, Francophone resistance to the position in which they were placed in this particular political economic regime was to, in some sense, internalize and accept it, but resist it by looking for zones of autonomy, zones of autarky, in which it would be possible to be faithful to the Catholic Church, remain more or less monolingual in French, and to remain within the confines of the Francophone nation understood in very 19th century terms as an organic whole embodied sort of quite literally in the bodies of Francophones no matter where they were in North America. And they traveled a lot since that was part of the nature of the colonial economy. Women in particular, and this I'm sure will be familiar to you, became the vessels of biological reproduction of the Francophone nation. So this was sort of what I think it was traditional spiritual nationalism, not connected to particular political territories, but connected to a privileged relationship to nature, and so very romantic national in that sense. And so the traditional bastions of Francophone Canada are rural areas where it's understood that we can be far away from the corrupting influence of the Anglos, whose bastions are the urban sites of capitalist production. And this is also the city and the country is a very old opposition from the 19th century that Raymond Williams talks about. So you have the city as sort of sophisticated and advanced and modern, but also filthy and immoral, and the country as a bit backwards, but as pure and true and natural. This spiritual nationalism shifted to a modernist nationalism quite late, but as part of the 1950s and 1960s post-World War II economic boom in Europe and North America, and part of the decolonization movements of that time. So there were very explicit linkages to the withdrawal of empire from Africa, for example. Civil rights movement in the United States. One particular intellectual architect of the Francophone minority rights movement published a book in 1966, I think, which was called The White Niggers of America, for example, and which sort of broke apart the spiritual nationalism to focus on Quebec as the focus of the nation state. And one of the major shifts there was to move away from the Catholic Church as the institutional organizer of Francophone life to the secular state. what this meant in educational terms was that Francophone Canada moved from a situation in which the church was responsible for education to one in which the state was responsible for education. When the church was responsible for education, what it did was to largely reproduce the very small religious and professional elite through picking, through either taking the sons and daughters of the elite families or picking particularly promising young people from the villages in which priests would be responsible for the education of younger kids and send them to seminaries in which they would be brought together with other promising young kids, and for the poorer kids, education was paid. So there was a reproduction of a small elite based on sort of highly selected minority of kids, and who would then essentially act as brokers between the Anglophone capitalists and the mass of Francophone workers, most of whom did not get access to education beyond elementary school, if that. Instead, they went to work quite quickly. There are gender differences. More girls stayed in school than guys, which for reasons having to do with the masculine nature of labor and primary resource extraction. And more girls were brought into the teaching profession, at least until they got married and had kids. But on the whole, that was how it worked. And so one of the first acts of the Quebec government was to democratize education and make it compulsory for everybody, on the grounds that if this form of nationalism is going to, if we are going to be able to use the apparatus of the state to shift the economic position, the politically and economically marginalized position of Francophones in the Canadian political economy, we are going to need people with an education that is adequate for the kinds of management skills that we are shut out from because we don't have them. We not only don't have the sort of the family ties which allow us to do apprenticeships, we don't have the technical skills. So that we have a move from the old model of what was called the Collège Classique, minority elite education, to the Polyvalente, which is a school, a big, huge school, drawing in thousands of kids from broad areas, and which are designed to give kids the skills to be able to enter into the private sector. Now, these also, the other shift that Quebec did was to change the post-secondary system so that you have essentially more points of entry into the work world than you would have had before. Now, the other thing that was important in this shift was because these schools were argued for as necessary responses to the particular needs of the Francophone nation, they also were understood as being spaces where the Francophone nation would be able to still reproduce itself. And so whereas in the past, entering into the private sector necessarily meant having to learn English, now the notion was that we need to be able to enter into the private sector as Francophones. Now, this became particularly important, in fact, outside of Quebec, where Francophones then constituted a very small minority of the Canadian population, and where after Quebec made the move of taking itself out of French Canada, if you like, fragmented French Canada, what you had from the 1970s and then increasing in the 1980s was a series of political struggles across Canada, the latest of which was only about 3 or 4 years ago, for the political rights of Francophone minorities to school in which French would be the only language of instruction. So schools here are understood as both spaces to reproduce the Francophone nation, but also privileged spaces for Francophones understood as a nation to get access to the kinds of technical skills you need in late capitalism. So we have these spaces as spaces where modernist nationalism, schools as places for producing national citizens, meets late capitalism, schools as places for gaining access to both technical and authentifying skills. And you have this playing out in different areas in the rural and urban areas, the traditional bastions in late capitalism, have undergone a huge economic crisis since primary resource extraction, fishing, lumber, and so on, and also the working class neighborhoods of industrialized communities have undergone a major crisis. And you have increasing urbanization of the population and increasing immigration and globalization. And so you have both commodified identity and commodified language emerging, but unevenly, insofar as the traditional bastions have invested more in the commodification of identity, and the expanding urban populations have invested more in language as a technical skill. So this creates a real problem, a real tension in minority language schools. Again, I would say you find this heightened in minority French language schools outside Quebec, but you also find them in exactly the spaces in French language schools in Quebec where you have large groups of immigrants. And to an increasing extent, also larger and larger groups of English speakers who are now interested in gaining access to legitimate French language skills, as Francophones have indeed gained access to social mobility and increasingly control at least the market of Quebec. And so the value of French-English bilingualism has become increasingly important. The struggle is partly over how to gain access to that bilingualism. What a lot of minority language educators say is that l'anglais ça s'attrape. English is something that you catch, like you catch a cold. So you don't need to go to school to learn it. You'll learn it anyway. But if you want to have the other part of your bilingual repertoire, you need to have a monolingual school in which to do that. Many working class Francophones argue that that's fine for the elite, which has the money to go on holiday to the United States or to England, or to pay for tutors, or to gain access to English in other ways. But for them, access to English is not so obvious, and they do depend on schools for that. And so we have quite major class-based debates across Francophone Canada. Right now, they're actually the most acute within Quebec, over whether schools should or should not be sites for access to English. What the old modernist elite says is, you know, look, we have been spending 200 years trying to protect ourselves from the English. We don't want to have English come in through the back door into our own institutions anymore, while the working class says, that's fine for you, what about us? I recall a conversation that some relatives of mine and I had in a small town between Montreal and Quebec City one summer. We were, between the four of us, we were having a conversation in three different languages for reasons having to do with our trajectories. And after a while, the waiter stopped and he said, you know, this is killing me. You guys are having conversation in three languages. My government won't let me have access to English. I can't even go to Montreal to get a job without English. I'm stuck here. So there are these very strong feelings about how these linguistic resources get distributed unevenly and how that places people. On the other side, the fun side, has to do with the ways in which this tension over bilingualism does position certain kinds of people who do have access to both in places where they can push back against the very strict boundary controls through various forms of bilingual jokes, essentially. So I've given you a couple of examples here. In Quebec, there's a sign law which says that you can only have signs in French in public spaces, or maybe other languages smaller. And so one of the first things that happened after this law was passed was that there's a store that opened up near my mother's neighborhood called Chouchou, which means sort of sweetheart, little darling in French. But if you say it with an English accent, you can figure out what they actually sell. They sell shoes. I don't have time to go through some of the others, but you have lots and lots of what I think of as kind of post-national playing around with language and a kind of an ironic distance from the deep seriousness of modernist nationalism, which goes along with this kind of moving out of the modernist nationalist sort of hegemonic frame. And I'll tell you a little bit about, this is a rap group from a Francophone minority area of Nova Scotia. And they were, one of their famous songs is called Jacuzzi. You can, it's on YouTube. You can Google it. They're sort of around, they're wearing these funny costumes, and there are these sort of strange Japanese anime characters. And their refrain is, y'a de la place en masse dans mon jacuzzi. There's lots of room in my jacuzzi. What they explain is that, you know, they use humor. There's, you know, it's funny, it's lighthearted. But what they mean is, there is lots of room in my jacuzzi. We don't all have to be Francophone in the old nationalist sense. We need to rethink what being Francophone means in order precisely to be able to include the immigrants, the indigenous people, the Anglophones, for whom French is also valuable capital, who are interested in participating in the world that we have been able to construct. And we aren't in a position to reproduce essentially the same mechanisms of exclusion against which we have been fighting. And so I think you know, what we have now is a situation in which the notion of minority is actually being reinvented. So we have, you know, an increasing presence of the notion of minority languages as added value, but also the minority position as a privileged one with respect to access to multilingualism, which in and of itself is an index of cosmopolitanism, and certainly in many cases actually provides the grounds for doing cosmopolitanism, for doing the kind of flexible mobility that's a hallmark of late capitalism. We do still have a couple of questions, though, which remain, I think, very relevant, and I'll leave you with those. We still need to ask, who owns the linguistic resources? Who gets to produce them? Who gets to control their circulation? Who gets to consume them? And who gets to define their value? What are the conditions of the market which allow certain kinds of people in certain kinds of positions to have more control over who gets to do what with language than others may do? So I'll stop there.
How many thanks, Monica, for a very thought-provoking lecture. Those questions will stay with me, I'm sure, for quite a long time. We have a little bit of time for comments, questions, observations.
Comparisons, parallels.
All right. Yes,
awesome. Yeah, thank you a lot. I don't have a question, but rather a comment, in that we are analyzing a similar debate on bilingual schools here in Finland. I'm doing it together with Sally Boyd from the University. So we recognize quite a lot of these discourses that you present here, about resources and rights and who owns, in this case, Swedish. Mm-hmm. Finnish-speaking parents want their children to go to bilingual schools, but Finnish legislation doesn't allow that Swedish and Finnish-speaking, bilingual Swedish and Finnish education is taking place. It should be monolingual, parallel.
Right.
Parallel monolingual. So the Finns wants to get into Swedish and Swedish culture, but there is a fraction where they are afraid of letting them in because they think that will be enough.
Yep.
So
this is ours. We don't want to share it.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's exactly the issue.
Really interesting.
Yeah. Reta. Absolutely. Yeah, no, I mean, I think in that sense you get, you know, all of the discourses that have emerged over the last, I don't know, 200 or 300 years or so, we have a much shorter history than you guys do, are still with us, right? So those discursive elements are still there. They don't necessarily appear in the same way all the time, and they're not necessarily used in the same way all the time. But you get sort of all of the above. Very often, you know, the same person will at the same time say, I really want to learn Spanish because I want to be able to get involved in the circulation of trade across the Americas, and I want to be able to do volunteer work in Guatemala, but I will not learn English. I don't want to learn English because English is the old class ethno-enemy. So, you know, so one set of things gets constructed in a kind of a late capitalist way, another thing gets constructed in a kind of a post-colonialist way. I think where you probably get the biggest shift is in positioning with respect to the for the First Nations, with respect to the indigenous population, where there's been more of an acceptance of the colonizing position of Francophones. Although even then, it was just a couple of years ago that somebody in Saskatchewan was telling me about a farming village where the farmers have gotten too old to farm and their kids don't want to do farming anymore, actually can't do farming anymore. And so the farms are being sold off, and this guy got a phone call from somebody saying, quick, 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 you've got to find us some Francophone immigrants really fast because the Sauvages are buying up our farms. So the notion of the term Sauvage this does still circulate. So you've got these kinds of layers. That's really variable. It's unbelievably variable. I think for some indigenous groups, French is like who? You know, just completely irrelevant. For some indigenous groups, you know, why are they getting all the resources? You know, it's another, element of white settler privilege. For others or other individuals, especially those who are on the territory of Quebec, in some sense, they have easier access to both French and English than whites do, and so some people do try to use that to their advantage. So, you know, I think you name it, really. You've gotten it, I think, but there are ways in which I've seen some Francophone lobbying groups or politically organized groups try to make alliances, in particular with the Métis, in ways which make a lot of sense from a Francophone perspective, legitimizing the position of Francophones. And they tear like, now you've discovered, that we exist all of a sudden. All right, we'll talk, but we ain't promising anything. And so I think there's probably, I don't know a lot about it, and there isn't much research about it, but there's certainly, I've seen particular places where a whole bunch of Francophones decided to get their Métis card because they could actually claim indigenous ancestry. How they're received, I don't know. I think it's an interesting question. There was something.
Dina Sarinen from the Center for Applied Language Studies, EXTRO. Thank you, that was really interesting. I was thinking about something you said about education, and I think it links with Sally's point about Finnish bilingual education, because in modern education systems, education was kind of the way for social advancement, it was a possibility. And now it seems your example of the Francophone schools, saying we don't get what we need in our education. And I know that in Osas and Sally's data, there have been examples of saying that, okay, we don't want the bilingual schools, but you can maybe offer them on a private sector, which kind of privatizes the educational provision. I think that's a really interesting phenomena in this. If education is not the thing that it used to be, what is? Is it linguistic resources or what?
Well, I think, how should I say this? It's sort of based on what I know empirically, okay, which is the only way in which I know how to answer these, these questions. I think the French language schools that I know are traversed by this tension, which is not easy to resolve, between our older understandings of schools as the place where we produce citizens, and a newer understanding of schools, which is a place where we gain skills. Now, I wouldn't want to say that the skill talk is entirely new. Obviously that was always there. And it was certainly there in training, in schooling for the working class, right? Home economics so girls can learn how to cook, right? Or shop so that the guys can learn how to make a table. So, you know, technical skills, I think, have always been part of the picture, but having the same stuff, language for the purposes of this conversation, be understood as both the material of citizenship and a technical skill, right? That's where things are interesting. And that's where you have, tensions between, some people who say, look, if you're not interested in this stuff for citizenship purposes, then don't be here. This is not what these schools are for. Other people saying, well, you know, what does it mean to be a Francophone citizen? What does it mean to be a citizen of Quebec? Does it mean that, you know, one of my ancestors has to have come across on some French boat from Normandy in the 1600s? You know, I don't. I come from Ethiopia, you know. So what are you going to do with me? So that's the tension, and it plays out every single day. Certainly in schools, you see it in public debate as well. And so, you know, what I'm trying to do now is to follow this tension and see what happens with it.
So, I've been working on Central Eastern European contexts, and I have read your works, and I think they work very well with the Canadian context and even with Finland or other Western European contexts. But what's your opinion on the Eastern European context, where the fall of the Soviet Union and the fall of the empires has brought along a new kind of a wave of nationalism? And so I know they have some of the same processes that you mentioned also available there, but it seems to be simultaneously have this post-national and, Brubaker has said, this post-multinational processes.
Yep. Yeah, no, yes. I mean, I do not want to claim that it looks the same all over the globe, right? Clearly, it doesn't. So we have an uneven distribution, which I think is actually in our interest to try to understand. So I think it's really interesting to look at different ethnographic contexts and try to figure out, you know, which of these features are there, which are absent, which, you know, other ones are there that we hadn't, you know, seen before. How does this link up to how different populations, let's say, are positioned differentially with respect to the globalized new economy?
I have one more question. And so, we as experts, it seems that Western experts have not come up with another idea than going through the same kind of development from nationalism to some kind of multicultural culturalism and so forth. For what has been seen, for instance, in the Ukraine or in Belarus, what the experts are saying that you should find yourselves to homogenize nationally the country and linguistically make one language for all education use and exclude others first, and then you can think about multiculturalism. So is it actually so that we as experts have come up with no other option for this kind of development?
I would like to take myself out of that particular pool. you know, insofar as I've been spending my career, in fact, arguing within Francophone Canada that we do not want to reproduce exactly the same mechanisms of exclusion that we are fighting against, right? This is great for us. Life is better for us, but then it then creates our own others and our own exclusion. So this is not a solution as far as I'm concerned. You won't be surprised to find out that this is not a popular position to take, right? And I have lots of colleagues who take precisely the position that you're talking about. I have one particular buddy that people love to put us together, Joseph Yvon Thériault, who likes to think of me as the destroyer of the nation. Mm-hmm. I take it as a compliment, actually. So, I think we can imagine other things. The question, we have a couple of questions, I think it is interesting and important to try to understand why people remain invested in the discourse of nationalism, who does, if you like, and who doesn't. I don't, you know, can't say I have something better, you know, a utopia to provide. Rather, I think, the path that I've taken has been to try to understand what purpose these particular kinds of differences serve in the organization of economic relations. So for me, in the end, I always end up going back to what we're trying to accomplish economically and how we can organize ourselves to do that in a way that's more rather than less equitable, although, you know, I don't have any fantasy that we're going to do this perfectly anytime soon, and probably not ever. But I think it's really important to move away from the idea of the nation as being a natural object and understand it as something that we cooked up, and we can uncook it.